Okay, I'd like to welcome everybody to this week's IMGD speaker series. I'm Rob Lindemann from the tech side of the IMGD program. Today we're very fortunate to have Chris Cipolli, that's how you pronounce his name, join us to give a talk about game design and specifically about work he's done on The Blob. Anybody played The Blob before?
Blob.
Anybody
heard of The Blob? Blob it up!
Have any of you guys played the demo of The Blob? The Blob, yeah, nice. It's free, guys. You can get it. It's called The Blob, T-H-E. They, you know, movies, games.
Okay. So I'll just get out of the way. I think Chris can tell us a lot of interesting things.
Great, guys. Thank you so much for coming today. And, you know, thank you guys for having me so much. Like he said, my name's Chris Cipolli. I've been working in the games industry, you know, underneath it all for about the last 12 years. So, for me, it was a pretty interesting project that we actually just got done taking care of. The title of our lecture today is From the Classroom to the Console, Deconstructing the Blob. And I think it's going to be, especially when we talk about the history of the game, I think it should turn out to be a pretty interesting topic because it involves people and involves classes just like this one. Let's go. That one's not going to work for me, is it? Oh, there we go. So here's a little bit of the history of the Blob. So in 2006, nine students that were studying game design and development at Utrecht in the University School of the Arts in the Netherlands were asked to create a game that was basically going to show the remodeling of the downtown area of Utrecht, the train station area. And what they were actually commissioned to do was show what that area was actually going to look like in 10 years. So these nine students took about 4 months and basically created this game that was ends up being displayed in the terminals in the station's information centers. The game that resulted from that whole thing, again freeware, something that you can download, is called The Blob. So in early 2007, a company that I was actually working for called THQ Incorporated saw the opportunity. The Blob was actually getting a lot of awards. There was a lot of international acclaim for some of the concepts that the whole thing was actually built upon. You get a big company like THQ, EA, you know, Ubisoft, THQ just happened to beat them to it. They basically got in there, offered these guys a little bit of money, and basically bought up the licensing rights for the game of the Blob. It's funny, the one thing they actually didn't buy up was the design for the main character, which the guys over in Utrecht were really intent on keeping, which I think is hilarious, but we'll actually get to that in a second. So they actually turned around and took two of their studios. At the time, THQ had 16 full studios, and basically put us full-time on what was going to be the Blob. So THQ basically put Blue Tongue Games, which is actually down in Australia, and actually Helix, which was right up here in Burlington, Massachusetts, which I was a lead designer for. So we basically had this project fall into our laps and were asked to reconstruct it. I think I'm getting my water in the way. So basically in the concept of the demo is this. The player controls the Blob character, which is basically just an innocuous creature that has the ability to change size and pick up colors just like you would if you were mixing a paint. And in a monochrome world, they were actually turning around and with the mouse controlling that Blob character and painting the world that was actually around you. It's quite interesting. So the game mechanic itself, again, was based on the mouse. The one thing you actually had to avoid, they had an enemy unit called an ink agent. An ink agent was basically just this black unit. And if you actually happened to come in contact with this black unit, you would turn around and spread black paint and be coloring the world black for negative points. The only thing you could actually do at that point was wash yourself off. So that was pretty much the underlying mechanic that we actually had to work with. The primary goal of the game was to paint 17 landmark buildings in an open world environment that was the futuristic Utrecht. And the secondary goals, they had, and it, you know, nothing major, just 50 little coins that they spread out all across this levels. And the game itself was more of an action platformer, 50 little coins that they turned around and you could collect on the side. Got to get close enough. I'm telling you, it's going to make me fall over these cords. I can feel it. So this is actually a screenshot that I grabbed of it. As you can see, it's just kind of it's a wacky little game. Here's the main character that I was alluding to before with his three eyes and his sneakers. No idea. But they basically had anything in the world could be painted. As you can see, everything's gray. You can paint these cars. You can paint all the buildings actually behind you. From a UI standpoint, from the user interface, the user interface is pretty minimal. Basically have your score up on the top. you have the amount of landmarks that were actually painted, and right below it, as you can see, the amount of coins that have actually been collected. Now, this one was an interesting one that we ended up kind of struggling with a little bit. This is basically your size indicator. This blob character can pick up to 10 pieces of paint. And when they ran over 10 citizens, they basically were at their largest size. And they actually had some limitations based on their size that we, when we were going in and developing the game, had to choose whether we were going to use or we were going to discard. So our jobs as designers, and especially for me as a lead designer, when working with licensed material, is you have a couple choices. You really, what you want to do is, from the demo, from the movie, from whatever piece of entertainment that you're actually building a game upon, you want to evaluate what they did right, and what they did wrong. Especially in this case, since we're working on a demo for a game, you know, it was something that we really needed to, right off the bat, turn around and identify. We want to evaluate ways that we can turn around and improve the overall property, because the property itself was something that you want to be lasting. You want to turn around and create something that creates sequels. You want to be able to create an intellectual property that can grasp the imagination. You want to build the established intellectual property to reach your target market. And for us, the target market was E for Everyone. And you're seeing it a lot in games these days. Hardcore gamers, casual gamers, pretty much anybody that you can turn around and get your hands on. You know, because, again, a lot of it's about profitability. So you want to hit as many people as you can, male and female, all ages. When we're actually deconstructing the blob and looking at the original game, the thing that we actually loved about it and some of the things that we took away from it directly were the concept. Controlling a ball of paint that mixes and matches colors to paint a monochrome environment is awesome. Literally. It's what we call a great hook. And when we're talking about a hook and when you're talking about pitching a game, I can sit there and say that top line to somebody in an elevator, and anybody's going to understand right off the bat exactly what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the game. And that's something, I'll tell you, that it really gave the blob a leg up. And it's a reason it had so much fame. What we also really liked was the playability. And you'll hear a playability a lot. It's basically all about access from a casual game standpoint, from a hardcore standpoint. How easy is the game to pick up? How easy is it to get into the game? The blob was fantastic. It was based on a mouse move, and anywhere you moved your mouse, you moved your ball. So basically, as you can see, it's sitting in an information center just like this. I walk up, I put my hand on this mouse, I start moving this mouse, I'm into the game. So the playability from our standpoint was absolutely fantastic. And it was something that we wanted to make sure that we kept our eye on. Lucky for us, you know, especially when designing for the Wii, perfect, right? I can have a 3D character, I can control a 3D ball like this, and it's easy, trackball. We actually instituted a couple interesting things like combat, but combat for us was absolutely simple. We pretty much had it. You could lock on a target and jump, and jumping was as quick as this, a little bit of a jump, a little bit of jump back and forth. You can actually spring yourself back and forth in the game. So really for us, especially on the Wii, we knew it was something that playability was going to translate absolutely perfectly. And the big thing we hinted on and we really liked was the presentation level. As you could see from that screenshot that I was showing you guys, the presentation's fun. It's funny. The game doesn't take itself too seriously. And sometimes a lot of games do. And believe me, I've been working in this industry for 12 years. I'm just as guilty as that as well. I've taken my job way too seriously, and I've made games that probably could have used a little bit of a step back and just kind of accept them what they want. They're entertainment. They're fun. We're here to entertain people as designers. So that's something that I think was just absolutely fabulous that these guys got as students. Funny, all about paint, messy game. Games, you're throwing paint everywhere. There's sounds going off. There's animations. There's cars, and they're beeping, and there's little cars riding around. It's absolutely fun. So it's something that we absolutely zeroed in on immediately. The whole visual property of the game, the presentation that they had, and it was something that we were intent on making sure that we continued on with when we created the Wii game. When we're deconstructing the blob, one of the things that we thought that didn't work, and a lot of this honestly is not any fault from the guys that made the game, from the students. They had a total different job. There's different expectations when making a demo, different expectations when making a product that's basically sitting there in a train terminal that's only job is to basically provide a couple of minutes of entertainment from a casual game standpoint, as opposed to something that we're asking you to come out and pay $49.95 for, or $59.95 even for a Wii title. So it's one of those things that we actually really want to see what we actually didn't think worked for it. A big one is the premise. And in the premise of the blob is you're literally just nothing but a blob. There's no backstory. You're a blob, you're rolling around the world, you're painting the world. These ink guys just happen to be ink guys. We actually saw a great opportunity that we can create a whole universe and a whole world that was going to make sense for this character. And the big thing for us, we ended up having a problem with was the lack of focused gameplay. Now, the gameplay for the blob was interesting, and we found, boy, it was so easy to jump into that game and like the way the game feels and paint around for a bit. But the one thing that we never found, and any of us from a design standpoint, or any of us that demoed it, was any type of longevity of the game. There was no build-up from a gameplay standpoint. There was pretty much just, I'm a ball of paint, I can mix paints, I can paint a monochrome world, and that was pretty much about it. What we really saw was a huge opportunity to build upon that gameplay model, not only from an action-adventure standpoint, from a platform standpoint as well, and as we talk from a level design. And so there was a lot of opportunities there, and as you can see, this one just goes on and on. But I think there was a lot of things that we felt that we could do. So for the premise, the biggest thing that we actually wanted to do was create a conceptually complete world, as I was alluding to before, that builds upon the core concept of the game, builds upon the fact that you're nothing but a ball of paint that's rolling around picking up colors and painting a monochrome world. Again, underneath it all, brilliant, great hook, something that everybody can get. We want to make sure we encapsulated that and build upon it. But we want to really, more importantly, we want to make a living and breathing backdrop upon which our game and our story can unfold. And from a designer, that is one of your main purposes, is your vision, is your understanding of the universe. It's weird about the blob, it's weird about that game. I could probably tell you the way the ink soldiers think and the way they would react in certain situations, but that's how you approach it. You approach it from a psychological standpoint, a conceptual standpoint, as well as a technical standpoint, which is something that we'll actually bridge on a little bit later. But the big thing that we want to do was establish an identity for the main character, establish a deeper sense of antagonism, right? The sense of good and evil. Look at games, your favorite games. It's easy to interpret good and evil, right? You have a diametrically opposed points, and this is basically what you're looking to create by establishing a premise. You're creating one side and then turning on the other side. What's the force that's against your main character or against your side? We actually want to establish a story, a backstory, the whole thing, and erect the infrastructure that we as developers could use to deliver a story. A lot of people sit there and go, oh, okay, delivering a story, there is no story. Well, think about it. NPCs, characters that you can actually use as a vehicle, the mechanics that make storytelling possible. We're talking about a demo, so basically the demo had none. It was something we had to take a step back of and turn around and release in order to turn around and build it into a full game. So creating an identity. Again, I get a kick out of this guy. Keep in mind, this is the one thing that Utrecht wanted, was to make sure they had this little guy with his shoes. This was the main character of the demo. But basically for us, what we're doing is, again, we're trying to create an identity. From both a visual and a conceptual standpoint, we want to establish the main character and their place in the universe, and in turn create a sense of purpose. The sense of purpose is what we want to turn around, and you as a player, we want you to adopt that. We want you to feel what the blob feels. We want you to want what the blob wants, because this is the main character. This is basically who we're asking you to be for however many of hours that we're asking for the gameplay to be. Again, in the blob, the main character is no more than, again, an alien creature that has an ability to mix and match paints. No more, no less. It never really had to get any deeper than that. But we, trying to establish this game, knew we were going to have to dig ourselves a little bit deeper. First thing we did, I figured I'd throw this in here for all the artists. Any artists in the class? You guys actually here for art? Yeah, right on. That basically the first thing we did was conceptualize. And I'll tell you, in any game development, the conceptual portion of developing games is usually some of the funnest stuff, really, because you can just let people go nuts. And we came up with some pretty interesting ideas for who the blob is. One of my favorites is Tang Guy up here. Basically, you can see he has a straw hanging out of his mouth, and he's filled with liquid, which I think was just hilarious. It was something that we actually kind of tried to pick up on. Yeah, I don't know. Angry piece of London broil? I'm not sure. But the one that actually really, and you focus test this stuff, right? You're sitting there liking to think that you're the one making these decisions, but we're bringing together classes just like yourself and talking about these characters and basically talking about which characters you identify with and which characters you like the best. The one we basically got the most from was Brainiac up here, who basically has a little bit of a brain floating in the middle of his head, which is hilarious. Yay for concepts. So our next step was to kind of reevaluate what we were actually going for there, and the next step we turn into was bat blob, as we call bat blob, because you can just hear the da-na-na-na-na-na-na, bat blob, right? He's, you know what I'm saying? He's basically there to kick a little butt, to do what he has to do. Funny, and turns around, again, was we got more people together, we talked about it, and again, the reaction was just that. He looks angry. It's like, does he have to be so angry? I understand we want him to save the world with color, but does he have to be so mad about it? So we decided, and you know, through a few more iterations, that no, he actually didn't have to be so mad about it. And this ended up being the main character of our game. Interesting, you know, the little offshoot eyes, little Bill the Cat eyes, you know, looks a little kooky, looks a little nuts, has the funny ears, you know. Something like that, again, especially casual game market, we're looking to approach males and females of all ages. Something that when we were focus testing this, we were getting a great reaction, especially from the female part of our audience. And I'll tell you, as you guys are moving forward and getting into games yourselves, you are going to be asked to continuously think about how to reach the female audience. Because I'll tell you, you can throw out a shooter and all the guys are going to come running. You got to. We're going to be asked to figure out what it's going to take as from a marketing, from an industry standpoint, what it's going to take to attract those female, that female audience. So for us, we settled on our little character, the blob here. So the big question, I guess, is who is the blob? And this is a funny thing. You've actually have it happen in games a different way. We actually made a conscious choice to not define the blob for the player, to not give you too much information about the blob. And from a design standpoint, this was absolutely critical. What we really wanted to make was the blob a vessel. If the blob was angry, or if he was scared or mad, we wanted you as the player to decide. We wanted you as the player to make the choice of what you wanted this main character to be. Underneath it all, we found out that, you know what, he was just a ball of paint. But we were actually going to define our world in a completely different way. And it turned out to be this guy. Funny enough, our little ink guy. He's basically an ink soldier. And it actually rose up as our sense of antagonism. Funny enough, we got our information, again, our inspiration for all you guys out there in Artland, from Vinyl Toys, from VinylToys.com. We basically sat there and turned around and created this vinyl idea of what we thought was just a fun little guy, a Keystone cop, a dope. You know, we want these guys to get splatted. We want you to feel good about splatting these guys because they're just silly. And it was something we really felt strongly about. And we actually made the cut and went to our marketing department at THQ and said, we want to hang the game on this guy because we think this guy is so much more interesting. We want to leave the blob, the main character, as a vessel. So that's what we basically did. And in defining our antagonists, as I actually have up here, we create a sense of drama within our game, the idea of good and evil. And again, evil doesn't have to be evil. Evil could be funny. Evil can have so many faces. And it's just one of these things that, for us, as soon as we saw this character, we knew how we were going to drive this game forward. So the big thing for us is, again, putting in place that structure. And with that structure comes cinematics. Cinematics that you basically use to visually define your universe. It's certain story points in your game. Opening cinematics, closing cinematics. Cinematics it's at individual points between gameplay, between levels. It's one of those things that you actually have a chance from a load standpoint to stand outside your levels, outside the break in the action, and create... tell a story that the player is actually accepting of and expecting. If I'm in the middle of a level and they're blasting cinematics at me, I get just as frustrated as the rest of you guys. You never want to break gameplay. Never break suspension of disbelief. Really, so for us, it comes down to our cinematics and how we can actually use those cinematics to deliver our story. So as I was saying, we create that framework. For us, in The Blob, the Ink Corporation has removed the color from the city of Chroma City and enslaved its people. It's a big difference that we actually had from the demo. For us, in the demo, you would roll on citizens to collect color. In us, the citizens were enslaved. So you're basically starting with a completely monochrome world. We wanted no color in the world. So you're basically, citizens are put into little suits of armor, basically, that they can be released from. So it's kind of an interesting dichotomy, an interesting change that we actually made. So here is our opening cinematic. Funny, I actually have game trailers. Hilarious. Can you guys hear that back there? Let me try to turn it up. I actually can't break it. Oh, is the sound not jacked? Oh, sorry. thought we had all that. Oh, I think that was actually it. Wait, we'll get there. Do we got it?
I think that's it. Is your sound up on the machine?
I think it should be. Come on, baby. Okay, we can go on, no big deal. Okay. I guess I'll just ad-lib it. Hi, I'm a little guy, I'm walking. Here comes the Inkies, Comrade Black. He basically was the epitome of our antagonist. Oh no, here comes the Inkies. Basically, Zep heads is what we call these characters. They're pretty much, and we have our blob. We call him the Legless Hobo because he was just living out in the woods, right? He had really pretty much nothing going on. Inky comes and destroys the world, takes all the color from it. Here comes our Legless Hobo. Little bit of funny, right? Dun, 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 dun. Evil Empire music, insert here. The blob comes, finds out, decides to do something about it. As I was talking, we enslaved the citizens, so that was kind of interesting. Uh-oh. Looks like the color revolution are in trouble. Not so much.
You mentioned the color revolutions in Europe.
Oh, yeah. Dun, dun, dun. The blob. So, excuse the honesty, you can find it at GameTrailers.com. It's so funny. My the actual copy I had on my own computer was too high res. I was having a problem running the thing. So, just like anybody, I made the damn game, and I still had to go fishing at GameTrailers.com, just like everybody else, right? So, for us, it was kind of interesting. But what we actually think we did with this, especially opening the cinematic, it set up our drama, right? The Inkies are bad. They're led by Comrade Black. They basically took all the fun color from the world, and up stands the blob, up stands our main character to return that color to the world. The one thing that we kind of did that was a little slick was introduce the characters, and I'll get into them a little bit later, the characters that were going to end up being our NPCs, the color revolutionaries, the color underground. We just actually threw them in there, you know? Threw them in there as somebody else that was standing up against the Yankees. So for us, it actually worked out quite well. A couple characters you have, the professor, Artie, you know, basically does a lot of the painting for you, Biff and Zip. But basically what we did was we set up the infrastructure within that opening cinematic, establish who these people are going to see you again. You're going to see these people again. And we basically made sure that you kind of realize when you ran into them in the game, you're going to be like, oh yeah, I recognize them from the opening cinematic. So we can use those as the vehicles in which to tell our story in-game, from a mission standpoint especially. So the big thing for us was defining the gameplay in the blob, as we kind of alluded to earlier. And the big thing for me, and believe me, when it comes to gameplay, I could have a whole course for you guys, literally, on this game. The decisions that we made, the reason we kind of made these decisions is mind-boggling. It's been days. We were working on this, working on the game for a year and a half, so a lot of it went into it. But what I actually really want to focus upon was the structure of the game, and especially from a gameplay standpoint, creating the structure that turned the blob from a demo into the full-blown game that we released on the Wii. So for us, our main focus was to create structure to our world and create a better sense of focused, sustainable gameplay. Basically, gameplay that was layered upon itself. That you have your core mechanic where, yes, I'm a blob that can pick up colors and I'm going to change colors. What else can I do? What else do I do when I'm not picking up colors and changing colors and painting the world? And yes, I'm going to spend most of my time doing it, but we can't just ask you to do that for 8 hours and expect you to be pleased about it. So we want to actually talk about other things that we could implement. So for us, the keys to defining our gameplay was this, to define our overriding objectives, the core objective of the game, the level objectives, and the secondary objectives in efforts to create focused gameplay. We're talking about objectives that are critical and non-critical, and it's something that we'll touch on in a little bit as we kind of move on. Define and create incorporated layered mechanics such as missions, achievements, and activities. And those are just words that we're basically applying. I think everybody knows what a mission is, right? But you'll run across this in games all the time. Somebody might call, you know, achievements, they might classify it as something else. Activities could be thingamadoos. You just never know. You'll actually find that out when you get to different studios, the vernacular that they use. But this is how we chose to define it ourselves. And also, we want to bridge upon the introduction of assets. Unique buildings, hazards, and more challenging AI, the ramping of difficulty, and the ramping of, basically from a visual standpoint, the introduction of interesting AI and interesting hazards, basically to sustain sustain interest in the game. I'm telling you, this thing's going to kill me. All right, I think we're good. So for us, the gameplay objectives that we're looking at the Bob is just this. The core objective of the Bob is to paint and transform a world of Chroma City, freeing it from the monochromatic tyranny of the incorporation. Sure, it's been something we've been talking about from the demo, that it was established well in the demo, and something we adopted as well. But underneath it all, the level objectives are to score enough points through missions and activities within the world. Again, see missions and activities, and we're going to touch upon that a little bit later, within the world to open the sector gates and level gates before the timer runs out. Basically, what we decided to do with this world was create individual levels that were basically broken up into different areas, different sectors. And those sector gates were opened through the achievement of points. Now, we had missions and activities, critical and non-critical. Our game was bridging on being an open world game and being a linear level game. But the idea behind it all, from a level standpoint, is always in the levels you needed to score points. Then we had secondary objectives, engaging in achievements such as gathering and collecting power-ups, gathering patterns, painting billboards, freeing citizens, setting off color bombs, exploring the level, etc. Now, these were things that we reinforced at the end of every level. At the end of every level, you would basically come out and you would get printouts saying, this is how many sectors you've seen. This is how many bombs you set off. Because underneath it all, from a psychological standpoint, especially when you're thinking about it this way, when you're repeating this for 17 levels of a game, when I turn around and play the first level of a game, I know there's going to be, I'm setting up the expectation of, here is a printout of all the things you did and didn't do. So the second time I go into a level, I'm going to go, oh yeah, I get extra points for setting off these color bombs. Oh yeah, I get extra points for painting these buildings and freeing these citizens. So in our own right, we're creating a sustainable gameplay model that's following upon itself. We create the expectation, we follow up with the expectation, we carry it out through the game. And that's in one way that we can build sustainable gameplay. So talk a little bit about the missions. For us, the structure of missions, that these NPCs, and there were all four of these NPCs, would appear in each sector over and offer time missions to the player. Again, we put a timer in, and we'll talk a little bit about that later, for a lot of other reasons. There's reasons why people use mechanics like score and timer, and again, we'll talk about them. But from a mission standpoint, it's something that was pretty much to make sure you're putting some incentive into the missions. Multiple missions, that you can take multiple missions at any one time. No, nothing like a journal. We didn't want to kind of load the player down with all that stuff. We wanted to keep this game light, free, and bouncy. Because the player was bouncy. This is really what we were trying to accomplish. They have different difficulty ratings, which were pretty easy to actually see, just a display from a UI element. Missions can unlock other missions. Missions or challenges can guide the player through the level. And challenges can reward time points, additional challenges, and liberty. And the interesting thing we decided to do, again, we're creating that sustainable gameplay model. There was four main different types of missions that we offered. We offered a landmark mission that every time that there was a landmark mission, we offered it from the professor character. There was an arty mission or a paint mission that every time it was offered, we were offering it through arty. Combat missions, which again, I was talking about the combat and what what's better than combat. But Biff, the name of this character, he was the one that always gave you all the combat missions. And there was also race missions, again, just a mission from here to there, kind of point-to-point missions that were always given by the Ziff character. Something fundamental that we're actually doing here from a gameplay standpoint, by creating that type of setup, by making sure every landmark mission is always given by the professor, we're putting it in the player's head that every time they see the professor, they know what kind of mission they're going to get. Simple. You create this gameplay mechanic that this is the way the world is going to work. You create that law and that rule, and you sustain it between your levels. And again, at some point or another, the players can just make the decisions for themselves, whether they like Zip missions better than Arty missions, whether they like Biff missions better than landmark missions. It was a way for us to bridge the gap between an open world game and, again, more linear established gameplay. The next thing we actually invited you to do was activities, and there's a number of different activities. Now, the activities at their core were non-critical activities, but just things that we felt that you would run across as you were actually turning around and playing the game. So outside of the mission structure of the game, they would give immediate minor in-game rewards. Keep in mind that underneath it all, we're asking you to score points. Remember that scoring points is the progression mechanic in this game. So for us, there was just things that you could do. You could paint billboards for points. You can free citizens. You could do some free combat. Just find some Inkies and stomp some Inkies, always giving you some points. We actually added in a chaining mechanism so that if I was bouncing and there was if I hit another object within a certain time limit, we put multipliers on the score so we could turn around and chain. And free paint. Outside of a mission, I want to turn around and I want to paint every tree in the world purple. If you want to paint any tree in the world purple, sure, we're going to reward you for it. And, you know, go nuts. Again, everything was leading back in from an activity. It was all leading back into our main objectives of the game. The override objectives from the level standpoint to score points, and the main objective to free the world of color. Then after that, we actually talked a little bit about achievements. And achievements themselves are what I was referring to at the end. They basically were set up on a display that's nothing like, woohoo, level complete. This is the time that you had remaining. Such an amount of remaining time. Here's a bonus for you. This is how many zones were liberated. Things like percentage painted, percentage of the world painted, percentage of every object in the world's painted. Again, the one thing we're doing psychologically is reinforcing the patterns and reinforcing the things that we're asking you to do. You know, by displaying that, we're saying that these things are important. These are ways you can score points. So in that way, always back into the objectives of the level objectives themselves and the overall core objectives of our game. So that was a great thing that we were actually turning around and trying to do with achievements. And as you can actually see, with activities and achievements, with missions, they're all part of the same game, right? They're all basically meant to work off each other and feed into each other to give us our overall goal and our overall objectives. Okay. Now, as I was talking about guiding mechanics. Whoop, I think I lost a little bit. So there's certain things, and every time you see a score, you see a timer in a game, there's certain reasons that those things are actually implemented by game designers. There's reasons that their mechanics are actually in there. For us, the score was used to balance the progression of the game. As I was saying, we're opening levels, we're opening section gates. The score, we made sure the score was absolutely important. You put it on a UI, you let the player see it at all given time, so the score is extremely important for us. Every activity that you engage in within the game either increases or decreases points. Basic law within the game, law of the design. Levels are divided into various sectors and sealed by sector gates, yada, yada, yada. As I was saying, that the score was our driving point. We also actually had a level timer. And it was one of these things that I had a hard time dealing with, the level timer. I'm not a timed game kind of guy. Timed missions, sure, but timed games was one of these things that I was like, well, if I want to spend my time in a level and just painting a level for 5 hours and that's how I get my enjoyment, why would I stop you from enjoying that? Why would I stop you from turning around and indulging in that essence of the game? But I was basically overruled, sadly. So for us, we actually put a timer in. And the reason we actually did the timer was we found that we were getting people, and again, focus testing. We had Boy Scouts that were playing the game, what have you. We found that we were basically getting people to a point where they were just bored of the game. Without driving them forward, without basically asking them to interact with our virtual world, they would just walk around and paint and go, eh, and stop. At some point, it just ended for them. And it's something that we actually found in the demo and something that we really tried to avoid. So that's when we turned around and made sure we actually put a level timer in the game. The one thing that we actually did, though, was make sure additional time was rampant, that you can get additional time in a wild amount of ways. You can do it for making chains, you can do it for pinning whole blocks and freeing citizens, and it would pop out with a little bit of timers. Because again, if you wanted to indulge in painting the whole world purple, I really didn't want to stop you. But the timer in itself, again, was put in to drive the gameplay mechanic, to drive the interaction within the world. So again, time was the law. Everybody was victim to time. The player had to reach the exit gate before time expired, and if time ran out, the level was over, and they were asked to restart it.
I don't know if I can derail you, but just ask a quick question. You say you're overruled? curious, you're a lead designer.
Well, this is kind of the funny thing, and we were actually talking about it a little bit before this. Do you understand, underneath it all, I'm a lead designer and was a lead designer in the game. Working in games, there is always somebody above you, one way or another, that's going to have some type of comment and be able to give you feedback on the decisions that you're trying to make. I was a lead designer. There was a producer above me. We had a marketing team that was out in THQ that was investing $2 million to market to Blob. They wanted a certain product. Their expectations were actually built up as well. And especially for THQ, this was an IP that they really went out and wanted to get. THQ, as you guys know, most of the THQ titles are WrestleMania. A lot of them are based on licensed materials. They really wanted to establish their own IP. So you don't just kind of get a free pass when it comes to a game like that. There's a lot of chiefs that are involved and a lot of choices that are made. And I'm not saying you're designing by committee because again, you earn the respect of your peers around you for your design decisions, but there was definitely a lot of feedback involved. So we were focus testing ourselves with some local people. They were focus testing out at THQ out in California. THQ actually goes as far as to have they call them their fun committee. They employ a group of people that are literally about 120 people that literally just sit inside a room, play games, QA games, and provide feedback from a fun factor standpoint. So it's one of those things, the more and more corporate you kind of get, the more and more your choices are a little bit limited. Somebody else had a question too.
Just quickly, were there enough time bonuses that you could paint the whole world?
There was, but the one thing we kind of left a little bit open to how you found those time bonuses, and the time bonuses themselves, it was one of those things. I knew how to get the time bonuses. And in case any of you are playing, paint an entire block. When you paint an entire block, have you ever seen the little guys that roll out? We call them the radians. They roll out and they can be painted. Paint a group of radians, time bonus. So every block in the game, if there was four buildings together, paint those four buildings, it would pop out more time. So we tried to overflow and overflood as well. And missions as well were giving time. There was a couple mechanics we actually tried to use to balance it. Because I was that guy. I played the whole demo. I played the demo for hours. You know, I was that guy who was like, I think I want to paint the whole world blue. You know, just because it was an interesting thing to do, truthfully. I'm kind of wacky like that. So back to the program here. Two of our overriding mechanics, again, that are driving the gameplay, driving the decisions, creating the structure that we were looking for from our gameplay in the Blob, were score and time. The next two guiding mechanics that we actually put up was kind of interesting. Dean and I, we talked about this a little bit this morning, was the idea of pain points and the idea of death. So pain points, in their own right, the original demo, you could change sizes. You could basically collect, you were size small until you collected five citizens. At size citizen, you got a little bigger, you became the size medium. Size 10, you got even bigger and became a size large. And they actually slowed down the mechanic a little bit, so you were rolling around a little bit slower. Something interesting I think all you guys should take to heart that I think is just fascinating about these guys that created the demo. The whole game's based on just ball physics. Simple ball physics. Never once does the game break away from a physical standpoint. So you're always a ball. You're always a round ball. The only thing they change is speed. The whole way they make you feel like you're big and fat and sloshy is through squash shaders and animations. And we took on the same thing in the Blob. You never change from a ball. You're always a ball underneath this game. Both of them. So it's something really interesting to keep in mind. Where, again, perception is everything, right? The illusion that you're rolling into things and squashing off of things is... it sells itself, right? You never run into a ball. That ball never changes. It's always there. So kind of an interesting point. But for us, what we actually wanted to do, we wanted to get away from what we felt was becoming a little bit of a hard thing to get around was the large size. With all our focus testing, nobody liked to be large in our game. Nobody wanted to be slow. They wanted to be quick and nimble. They wanted to bounce around the world. They wanted to spring around. But again, action gameplay. We wanted to be fast and furious. So what we actually turned around and did, on the other hand, was come up with this idea of paint points. And the idea of pain points is this. Every time you run over a paint container and it's filled with paint, we add so many points. Every time you paint something in the world, we detract points. Again, a balancing mechanism that we basically never had to turn around and get to any play with the physics. You never got slower into Blob. You were always fast. You were always furious. It all just basically came down to paint points. And with the paint points, We had you. You had to. We worked in other mechanics. Enemies and vehicles and destructibles took so many pain points. We had landmark missions that required right on the side. We had a UI that you would just basically see the number 50. You would jump inside, shake the Wii controller around, and you wouldn't be let in. It was like a gate unlock for painting landmarks with pain points. So it served as a good mechanic of the game. And also, in one way or another, the nature of the game was fast and furious, and we kind of kept that fun factor up quite a bit. The other thing for us was death. The demo has no death. You can just play the demo until the cows come home. There is no death. You never die. You basically are inked, and nothing happens. You can paint the whole world black if you want to, which in one way or another, you can see some value to, and in its own right, it's kind of interesting. What we actually found, and what we were finding through focus testing, and we were finding through our own playback, was the player would basically never engage in the world. They would just get inked, and inked meant nothing to them. They're like, okay, I'm inked. So what we basically did was put in this idea of death. So every time you got inked, and believe me, we were inking you in many different types of ways, from puddles to AI like tanks and turrets, and we were inking you. Basically, a timer would pop up that would take the place of our pain points for us in the bottom corner. That timer would start kicking down. If you ended up having that time run out, you would die. You would explode. You would explode like a little black balloon. Boink! And pretty much respawn in the immediate area, but it was no big thing. But for us, again, keep the pressure on. Make getting inked important. We wanted to make sure our antagonists were important. We wanted to make sure that gameplay mechanic was just as important to the player as it was to us. So we instituted the idea of death. So again, in their own way, these four mechanics, these four overriding principles, literally totally changed our gameplay. We used it to hold together our gameplay format and what our experience was going to be. As you can see here, it's just another one of the screenshots of how the game actually ended up looking like. See, again, from an artistic standpoint, extremely colorful. We went completely crazy. We have a leech bot here. We have our little friend, the blob. Paint points displayed in the bottom right-hand corner. And again, harkens quite a bit from what we saw in the demo, right? Paint points displayed in the bottom right corner. Sector gates, the amount of gates that are open, and the score that you must achieve to open the next sector gate to move on. Your score right underneath it. Time in the upper left-hand corner. When designing the UI, the less intrusive, the better, right? Keep it to the corners. Give people the play space, especially in a game like this with a 3D world. Give them the play space to basically understand and give them the play space to be able to platform. So the big thing for us, the next thing, and I was alluding to it before, and you hear about it a lot from a gameplay standpoint, is ramping the challenge or ramping up the progression of the game from a challenging standpoint. In the demo, we absolutely had none. There was none of it. There was no ramp. You basically could paint things. You were asked to paint 17 buildings and pretty much go to it. You know, and as anybody that might have played the demo kind of didn't know when the game was done even. Big thing that you always kind of find from a challenge standpoint, from a design standpoint, from an asset standpoint, is you always want to keep people interested. Just think about it. Introduce new things to people over the gameplay experience, and it's going to keep them moving on to see the next interesting thing. Now, you can do this from an asset standpoint, and you could actually do this from an enemy standpoint, hazard standpoint as well. What you actually want to do is this, and at the core of it, and I'll probably just wrap this up a little bit and show you guys a little bit of a demo of the gameplay so you guys can see how all these words turned into action when we turned around and created the game. But from a gameplay standpoint, you know, by introducing different hazards, especially by introducing unique enemies. Now, enemies themselves, enemies' combat in our game was simple. You were inked or you were not inked. There were no hit points. We didn't basically deal with anything statistically. You were inked or you weren't. So it actually turned out to be pretty simple. What we basically dealt with was our inky soldier, our basic melee unit. We moved up to different ways that they could attack you. Heavy tanks with projectile weapons, sprayers. We had an inky tech that could basically lock onto you. We digressed with a little bit of speed. We made an inky soldier unit that was on a jet bike that would basically whip around and catch you. So these are kind of ways that you can introduce different gameplay. And right, you introduce these characters, say at level 1, you introduce the inky soldier. You turn around at level 3 and introduce the heavy inky. Now, on level 4, you use the inky soldier and the heavy inky together to provide challenge. And this is the way, with even a small amount of AI, even a small amount of creatures, that you can really, from a gameplay standpoint, get quite a bit of a work out of. So here's Your color, that's great. Again, sorry for the no sound. But this is pretty much how it turned out. As you can see, the characters are rolling around in the world. The world's off its hook, you know? Cool. Basically, the professor pops up. Our mission givers, as I was saying, you actually see them in the world from a landmark standpoint. He says, hey, why don't you jump in here and paint this landmark? We had a shake mechanic for doing something interesting with the remark. And again, the world was transforming. We were unlocking the world with color. That was pretty much what we were going after. And one of our favorites, the bomb. So for us, what we wanted to create again was a gameplay mechanic that was structured, that was focused, and basically turned around and was just an over-the-top, fun-filled adventure. Oops. Sure.
What's the thinking behind the kind of rotating arrow around the block?
The ribbon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, funny enough, it was from an art direction standpoint. Those guys just went crazy about it. It was pretty much just this a little thing that they thought was such a unique visual stimuli that, you know, we sat there.
It always makes it clear which way the blob is facing.
Which, again, from a mechanic standpoint, was absolutely perfect. But you'll actually see from an animation standpoint, we used that arrow, that rotating ribbon, in fascinating and weird ways. It was just, again, from a visual standpoint, it worked really well. And we sat there and said, let's turn around and get a gameplay mechanic out of this as well. So, again, as a lead designer, you turn around and you think about these things as much as you possibly can all the time. If somebody's going to ask for something, try to find a way that you can use it. So for us, you know, just the game for itself was released in September of 2008 and it did pretty well. You know, most of our scores were in the 80s. We've gotten 10 out of 10. We've gotten 9 out of 10. So for us, again, through that structure and through that introduction, the premise, and through our visual presentation, at least it was a success, critically. Interesting thing about the industry itself. This game, 10 out of 10s, 9 out of 10s, only sold 250,000 copies. So they're still going to turn around and make a sequel to it, right? Because you don't establish an IP with something that you actually can't turn around and build off of. You take the hit to build an IP. But again, something to keep in mind as you guys kind of get out there. Critical success of your peers, success from a review standpoint, does not necessarily always equal sales. And again, we are a sales-driven industry, so it's kind of important. And that's pretty much it for me. I was just going to open it up to questions for you guys.
I'm just curious, so to make something like this, what you guys did, what kind of time frame does it take? What kind of manpower? What kind of money? And then how many does it have to sell before that breaks even? And you can say,
well, the funny thing is that you usually end up having a number of what your cost is actually going to be from a production standpoint. As you're actually turning around and you take off what it's going to take to reproduce all the boxes, what it's going to basically take to print all the copies of the game, you end up with the number, you know, and you turn around and you know how many people it took, so you can take all their salaries out of it. Well, we went into it to thinking it was going to take a year, and ended up taking us about a little bit closer to a year and a half. We thought we were going to basically be able to release about 6 or 8 months earlier. But as we kind of got it out there from a fun factor standpoint, and we kind of got it out to California from a THQ standpoint, the feedback engine just started generating. So we ended up making the game in about 9 months, but probably end up tweaking the game, balancing the game for probably about another 7, really. So it ended up being a year and a half. And the team for us was... In Australia, it was about 65 people. We had a whole QA department out in California that was keeping an eye on it. We were about 45 people up in Helix, and we're working on the DS port specifically as well. So it's... It's a pretty wild thing. Again, you know, I have an opportunity to do it. Lucky for us, we had the proprietary engines. We already built the engines. We were building games previously for the Wii and for the DS. So that in itself, we never had the crush of trying to erect our tech at the same time. We basically had a good opportunity to stand back and just make it happen.
So I have two questions. One is, why didn't it make a lot of money? And the second one is, how did you divide the work between here and Australia? What was done here and what was done there?
Okay. Oh, well, for us, the why, nobody's really sure. You know, there's
like a really important question.
It is a really important question. But the weird thing is you can kind of delve and point a lot of fingers, right? From a development standpoint, we just want to make sure we made the best game we possibly could. And again, for us, from a critical standpoint, it seemed like it was received well. From a marketing standpoint, did any of you guys really hear about it before it came out? You know, there's a lot of things, how they spent their marketing dollars. You know, there's a lot of ways that games find success. Making a great game is usually just the first part about it. You know, you're still talking about selling a great game to the market. And for us, from a design standpoint, how we divided up from Australia and out here in Massachusetts, where we, from the get-go, decided that we were going to work together to basically come up with an overriding design that we were going to apply to both platforms. So from a design standpoint, we pretty much were doing the work side by side the whole time. A little tough, you know, it's morning for them when it's night for us. There was a lot of, I've got to sit there and be in the office at 8 o'clock webcasting when they're in the office at 7 o'clock in the morning and getting their coffee. So it was a lot of discussions, a lot of emails, a lot of communication. Luckily, we were working with a great team. Those guys are fabulous, you know, and Blue Tongue's going to go on and be making, they'll be making the sequel, so you guys will be seeing great things from them as well. They're wonderful. The Aussies are hilarious, too. Sure.
Since we're trying to appeal to men, women, and people,
right.
Is it a conscious decision to make all the blob appear asexual?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was one of those things. Again, what you're trying to do and trying to accomplish, especially for something like this casual game market, right? You're basically, we wanted to make sure that whoever was playing the game, they were having the ability to put into the blob whatever they wanted to put into it. You know, if you were a boy and the blob had a bow, it would change your whole perspective of who the blob is. You know, we could sit there and say that we might think he's male or we might think he's female, but it's something that we would never kind of let outside. We never kind of refer to him as too much.
But also, like in the opening cinematic, uh-huh. You showed at one point the corporation breaking into someone's house and there were two blob citizens.
Right.
They looked exactly the same, just different colors.
which is in its own right, again, color. Color was such an important thing in our world. You know what I mean? We want it, that whole idea that we do actually see some citizens with. There, I think there is a girl that's running around with a bow on. You know what I mean? But I think that's about as far as we go. You know what I mean? Even the little blob citizen that's walking out with the balloons, the child that falls over and the. I don't know. It's blue, but you know we pretty much wanted to kind of change the perception of how we were viewing our game. Anybody else? Yeah. I think every game suffers from feature creep, and that's the God's honest truth. I've been doing this for 12 years. I've never seen any game that at some point or another we didn't have a designer, or usually it was me, walk into a meeting room and freak out because somebody came out with what they thought was going to be the best idea that was going to change the whole gameplay mechanic and was the right call to make. That's where producers come in, right? You know, that's where guys that are in charge of the schedule come in because, like it or not, and it's something that, again, you guys are always, always, always going to have to keep in mind, and especially now, it's something you should remember. Right now, deadline-oriented industry. If I have a deadline for May 1st and THQ is going to pay my paycheck and I'm working at an independent studio, if I don't hit May 1st, I'm not getting paid. It's a deadline-oriented industry, and it's also, it's literally about making sure you hit your goals. From a marketing standpoint, we had almost $3 million behind this game, rolling in from a marketing standpoint. $3 million that they're going to basically go out and spend on this game. They have to buy the spots. They have to buy that ESPN spots 6 months in advance. What happens to that $3 million if they have to turn around and call up and go, oh, by the way, our game's not ready to release? You know? So it's tough. It's one of those things that, from a standpoint, you always want to change the game. You always want to make sure the game's better. But at some point or another, you got to stop. You know, and as a designer, it's important that you kind of realize that, you know, because underneath it all, it's going to be hard enough to complete what you have on paper, let alone to turn around and try to change it at the last minute. And for us, and again, it's all in balance, right? You want everything to work in balance. Some things work and some things don't. So, but feature creep is always around, and it always will be around, believe me. Anybody else?
Okay, let's thank our speaker.